Part 3. Deception. Chapter 10. Situation Room. In the country inn, the kind that might be found in Williamsburg or Newport during the season. Pale cream wallpaper overlaid with a diagonal pattern of blue and pink bunches of flowers. Early American wooden chairs decorated with whimsical chip-carved lunettes. A scorched fireplace beneath a milky white mantle, scrollwork made of Italian Carrara marble. Behind heavy drapes, a pair of floor-to-ceiling windows looked through the towering southern magnolias planted in 1830 by President Andrew Jackson in memory of his wife Rachel, and across President's Park to the Washington Monument. Brightly lit against the early morning light, the obelisk had the appearance of a spaceship about to rise. A spidery antique chandelier of cut glass and gilded metal hung in the center of the room. On the floor near the bed, Barney, the family's Scottish terrier pup, lay like a small sack of coal. It was Tuesday, January 30th, 2001, and George W. Bush had been president for 10 days. He strode quietly past the bedroom's walk-in closet and out to the west sitting hall, where, 4 decades earlier, Jackie Kennedy answered correspondence with swirling penmanship on her father's French Empire desk. Passing through the 8-foot wooden doors into the cavernous center hall, he turned left into the small family elevator. Inside, columns carved in the old mahogany walls framed mirrors on 3 sides to reduce the feeling of claustrophobia. Hidden behind the elevator was a private circular stairway he sometimes used. When the doors slid open at the basement level, the president crossed the diplomatic reception room, encircled by Jean Zuberessier's pastoral scenes of North America. On the south grounds, he stepped into the presidential limousine for the short ride to Fort Leslie J. McNair in southwest Washington for his morning jog. Secluded away on the point of land where the Anacostia River merges into the Washington Channel, the old red brick army post offered privacy, security, and space, 28 acres, for presidential runs. The old fort was originally constructed in 1791 to protect the nation's new capital city from invasion, but it failed when the British attacked in 1814. Washington was devastated, the White House was turned into cinders, and Fort McNair was leveled. But thoughts of an attack on the nation and failed defenses were probably a long way from the mind of George W. Bush as he sprinted beside the neoclassic National War College in the cold morning air. Back at the White House, a Secret Service agent nodded as the president, accompanied by Spot, stepped into the Oval Office. The small black-and-white English Springer Spaniel was born in his father's White House 12 years earlier. Just as Spot follows George W. Bush into the nation's most powerful office each morning, her mother, Millie, followed his father into the same place. Bush crossed the Reagan-era ivory, beige, and terracotta rug. It had replaced Bill Clinton's royal blue oval carpet on the morning of the inauguration. From the beginning, Bush made it clear he wanted nothing left from the previous administration. Bold colors were out, peaches and cream were in. Workers lugged away the plush red and cream silk-covered sofas and replaced them with beige couches. The medallions and busts of Franklin D. Roosevelt and Harry S. Truman were returned to a dark basement storage room, and the walls and tables were filled with family photos and rough-hewn artwork from Texas. On the north wall was one of the president's favorite paintings, Tom Lay's 1954 oil on canvas, Rio Grande, borrowed from the El Paso Museum of Art. Bush's taste in office decor is respectable middle America, said one observer. The new style and decor imply respectable, white, middle-aged, middle-class values. No perverts or radicals here. Assassination, the fate of his alter ego, William McKinley, was a topic that haunted George W. Bush since long before he became president. Not the possibility of his own violent death, but the assassination attempt against his father by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein shortly after the elder Bush lost the presidency. In fact, if the intelligence George W. was given was correct, he might have lost nearly his entire immediate family, including his father, mother, wife, and 2 brothers. Just as he sought to avenge his father's political loss, he would one day go after the man accused of attempting to murder his father and the rest of his family. After all, he would later comment when speaking of the Iraqi leader at a Houston fundraiser, this is the guy who tried to kill my dad. The drama began in mid-April 1993, as much of the country was focused on the tense standoff in Waco, Texas, between Branch Davidian cult leader David Koresh and federal law enforcement agents. About the same time that the FBI was flying two senior military officers to Waco to assess the situation, a few hundred miles to the south, in Houston, George H.W. Bush was quietly boarding a chartered Kuwaiti Airlines 747 for a trip to the Middle East. A private citizen for the first time in more than a decade, the former president was being thanked and embraced by the Kuwaiti government, which hailed him as a liberating hero for forcing Iraq out of their country. As the giant plane took off from Houston's Ellington Field on April 14th, the only passengers were former President Bush, his wife Barbara, their two sons Marvin and Neil, his wife Sharon, and Laura Bush. Her husband, George W. Bush, who had always avoided foreign travel, stayed home to oversee his interest in the Texas Rangers baseball team and to make preparations for his run for the governorship. Several hours into the flight, the plane landed in Washington, D.C., to pick up former Secretary of State James Baker, former Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady, and former White House Chief of Staff John Sununu. Once again airborne, the group toasted their reunion and looked forward to 3 days of victory celebrations. But in Iraq, across the border from Kuwait, many were still bitter and hungry for revenge. According to a senior administration official during the Clinton administration, during and immediately after the Persian Gulf War, Saddam, through his controlled media, indicated that President Bush would be held personally responsible for the war and would be hunted down and punished even after he left office. Prior to Bush's trip, the CIA began picking up some worrying indications that the IIS, Iraqi Intelligence Service, was planning to assassinate Bush now that he had returned to private life, and that the assassination attempt would occur only with authorization from Saddam Hussein. Other information the CIA received suggested that Saddam Hussein had authorized the assassination attempt to obtain personal revenge and intimidate Kuwait and other Arab states. On April 12th, 2 days before the former president's departure from Texas, the Iraqi intelligence service, Mukhabarat, held a secret meeting in the southern Iraqi city of Basra, 100 miles from Kuwait. Among those present was an Iraqi national named Wali al-Ghazali. According to justice and FBI documents, the meeting was to carry out the final arrangements for the assassination of former President Bush and the Emir of Kuwait. At the meeting, al-Ghazali was given a nondescript Toyota Land Cruiser, similar to thousands in Iraq and Kuwait, with one exception. Lining the skin of the vehicle was nearly 200 pounds of plastic explosives connected to a detonator. It was enough to create a devastating blast with a kill radius of 4 football fields. Also hidden in the car were another 10 bombs in the shape of cubes. They were to be planted elsewhere in commercial sections of Kuwait. The powerful car bomb was specially constructed so that it could be detonated either manually by remote control, by an electronic timer, or by a push-pull suicide switch. Al-Ghazali was given a photograph of the building at Kuwait University, where Bush was to receive an honorary degree. He was instructed to cross the border into Kuwait, then detonate the car bomb by remote control at the university close to the arriving motorcade. Finally, Al-Ghazali was given a bomb-encased suicide belt and told that if all else failed, he was to get as close to Bush as possible and then detonate it. In the dark of the morning on April 13th, the day before Bush was to leave Texas, al-Ghazali pressed down on the accelerator and turned his bomb-laden land cruiser toward Kuwait. A few hours later, he passed through the rough Kuwaiti border post of Salmi, a desert haven for smugglers and black marketers, where Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia come together like wedges in a cake. After he landed in Kuwait on April 15th, the welcome must have seemed like salve on an open wound to George H.W. Bush following his bitter election loss to Bill Clinton 5 months before. Thousands of Kuwaitis dressed in flowing white robes greeted his plane like an Arctic whiteout. There were girls with baskets of flowers, whirling sword dancers, and a rose-red carpet, Dubbed Operation Love Storm, the tribute included a perfume-scented motorcade route for the former commander-in-chief of Operation Desert Storm. As if still president, Bush and his family were feted and housed in the emir's expansive Bayan Palace. Literally everybody wanted to see the hero of Kuwait, said Tarak al-Mezrem, the Kuwaiti official who handled press arrangements for the Bush trip. We never had anything like it before. Bush called the reception terribly emotional and wonderfully fulfilling, and seemed to thoroughly enjoy himself as he toured oil fields once torched by Iraqi forces and greeted American troops. Then it was time for the major ceremony at Kuwait University. On the stage, Bush introduced his daughter-in-law. Laura Bush's husband, he said, is the owner of the Texas Rangers team. Now that I am just a citizen, I can root for any team I want. No one on the stage or in the audience knew how close they might have come to death. Through a series of misadventures, the assassins had been caught shortly before Bush went to the university. Had the plan worked, there is little doubt that George W.'s father, mother, wife, two brothers, and one of their wives would have been killed. According to a senior official from the Clinton administration, from all the evidence available to it, the CIA was highly confident that the Iraq government at the highest levels directed its intelligence service to assassinate former President Bush. As a result, about 2 months later, President Bill Clinton ordered 23 Tomahawk-guided missiles, each packed with 1,000 pounds of high explosives, fired at the downtown Baghdad headquarters of Iraqi intelligence. Although most hit their target, 3 of the million-dollar missiles went off course and destroyed homes in the area, killing 8 civilians, among them one of the country's most promising artists, Leila Al-Attar. President Bush was convinced, as was the Clinton administration, that Saddam Hussein had orchestrated the assassination attempts. But questions would quickly be raised about the quality of the intelligence and the evidence that led to the arrest and conviction of al-Ghazali and 13 others suspected of involvement in the plot. I tend to be extremely skeptical about this, a former CIA officer who worked in the region for years told the Baltimore Sun Scott Shane. The Kuwaitis would not be reliable sources. And Seymour M. Hersh, in an article in the New Yorker magazine in November 1993, suggested that the Kuwaitis might have concocted the plot, or at least its connection to the Iraqi government. He also raised serious questions about the physical evidence that tied Iraq to the plot. Even though al-Ghazali confessed and said his orders came from the Iraqi intelligence service, there was the possibility that torture or coercion was used. In a report on the trial, Amnesty International pointed out that the defendants were not allowed access to lawyers before the trial. The right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty was seriously jeopardized by statements made by Kuwait's public prosecutor at a press conference on 16 May 1993. He stated that the defendants were criminals who allied with the devil and conspired with him to try to assault Kuwait's honored guest, and that investigations proved without doubt that it was the Iraqi intelligence service which moved this rotten group of accused persons to execute the plans of the evil Iraqi regime. That someone would order the killing of his wife, parents, and most of his immediate family, and almost succeed, would burn in George W. Bush, as it would in anyone. In private, his raw hatred for Hussein was evident. "The SOB tried to kill my dad," he snarled at one surprised visitor. "I was a warrior for George Bush," said George W. at another time. "I would run through a brick wall for my dad." Despite the magnitude of the crime, Hussein had never been brought to justice. Now, as president himself, George W. Bush would have a chance to bring justice to Hussein. In a new administration that was determined to stay on message, the message for January 30th was support for faith-based education. Bush began the morning with an address to religious groups in the Indian Treaty Room of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, and spent part of the afternoon at a nearby school addressing the virtues of his plan. Standing in front of a banner that showed black and white photos of caregivers and was emblazoned Armies of Compassion, Bush said, "Real change happens street by street, heart by heart, one soul, one conscience at a time." But soon after the Armies of Compassion sign was taken down, Bush turned his attention to armies of a different sort. Shortly after 3:30 p.m., the Bush National Security Team assembled around the polished wooden conference table of the Situation Room, down the stairs from the Oval Office. Along the walls, cherry paneling hides large television monitors and maps with small flashing lights. Just 18 feet square, the tight conference room was once described by Nixon National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger as uncomfortable, unaesthetic, and essentially oppressive. As the 10 brown leather chairs around the table filled, place cards identified each of the players. On one side of Bush, who occupied the seat at the head of the table, was Vice President Dick Cheney, and on the other side sat Secretary of State Colin Powell. Opposite the president at the other end, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice acted as stage manager. "Condi will run these meetings," said Bush. "I'll be seeing all of you regularly, but I want you to debate things out here, and then Condi will report to me." Then Bush addressed the sole items on the agenda for his first high-level national security meeting. The topics were not terrorism, a subject he barely mentioned during the campaign, or nervousness over China or Russia, but Israel and Iraq. From the very first moment, the Bush foreign policy would focus on three key objectives: get rid of Saddam Hussein, end American involvement in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and rearrange the dominoes in the Middle East. A key to the policy shift would be the concept of preemption. The blueprint for the new Bush policy had actually been drawn up 5 years earlier by three of his top national security advisors. Soon to be appointed to senior administration positions, they were Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, and David Wormser. Ironically, the plan was originally intended not for Bush, but for another world leader, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. At the time, the three officials were out of government and working for conservative pro-Israeli think tanks. Perle and Feith had previously served in high-level Pentagon positions during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. In a very unusual move, the former and future senior American officials were acting as a sort of American privy council to the new Israeli prime minister. The Perle task force to advise Netanyahu was set up by the Jerusalem-based Institute for Advanced Strategic and Political Studies, where Wormser was working. A key part of the plan was to get the United States to pull out of peace negotiations and simply let Israel take care of the Palestinians as it saw fit. "Israel," said the report, "can manage its own affairs. Such self-reliance will grant Israel greater freedom of action and remove a significant lever of pressure used against it in the past." But the centerpiece of their recommendations was the removal of Saddam Hussein as the first step in remaking the Middle East into a region friendly instead of hostile to Israel. Their plan, a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm, also signaled a radical departure from the peace-oriented policies of former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was assassinated by a member of an extreme right-wing Israeli group. As part of their grand strategy, they recommended that once Iraq was conquered and Saddam Hussein overthrown, he should be replaced by a puppet leader friendly to Israel. "Whoever inherits Iraq," they wrote, "dominates the entire Levant strategically." Then they suggested that Syria would be the next country to be invaded. "Israel can shape its strategic environment," they said. This would be done, they recommended to Netanyahu, by reestablishing the principle of preemption and by rolling back its Arab neighbors. From then on, the principle would be to strike first and expand, a dangerous and provocative change in philosophy. They recommended launching a major unprovoked regional war in the Middle East, attacking Lebanon and Syria, and ousting Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Then, to gain the support of the American government and public, a phony pretext would be used as the reason for the original invasion. The recommendation of Feith, Perle, and Wormser was for Israel to once again invade Lebanon with airstrikes. But this time, to counter potentially hostile reactions from the American government and public, they suggested using a pretext. They would claim that the purpose of the invasion was to halt serious drug money and counterfeiting infrastructure located there. They were subjects in which Israel had virtually no interest, but they were ones, they said, with which America can sympathize. Another way to win American support for a preemptive war against Syria, they suggested, was by drawing attention to its weapons of mass destruction program. The claim would be that Israel's war was really all about protecting Americans from drugs, counterfeit bills, and WMD, nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. It was rather extraordinary for a trio of former and potentially future high-ranking American government officials to become advisors to a foreign government. More unsettling still was the fact that they were recommending acts of war in which Americans could be killed, and also ways to masquerade the true purpose of the attacks from the American public. Once inside Lebanon, Israel could let loose, to begin engaging Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran as the principal agents of aggression in Lebanon. Then they would widen the war even further by using proxy forces, Lebanese militia fighters acting on Israel's behalf, as Ariel Sharon had done in the 1980s, to invade Syria from Lebanon. Thus, they noted, they could invade Syria by establishing the precedent that Syrian territory is not immune to attacks emanating from Lebanon by Israeli proxy forces. As soon as that fighting started, they advised, Israel could begin striking Syrian military targets in Lebanon, and should that prove insufficient, striking at select targets in Syria proper. The Pearl Task Force even supplied Netanyahu with some text for a television address, using the suggested pretext to justify the war. Years later, it would closely resemble speeches to justify their own Middle East war. Iraq would simply replace Syria, and the United States would replace Israel. Negotiations with repressive regimes like Syria's require cautious realism. One cannot sensibly assume the other side's good faith. It is dangerous for Israel to deal naively with a regime murderous of its own people, openly aggressive toward its neighbors, criminally involved with international drug traffickers and counterfeiters, and supportive of the most deadly terrorist organizations. The task force then suggested that Israel open a second front in its expanding war with a focus on removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right as a means of foiling Syria's regional ambitions. For years, the killing of Saddam Hussein had been among the highest and most secret priorities of the Israeli government. In one stroke, it would pay Saddam Hussein back for launching Scud missiles against Israel, killing several people during the Gulf War. Redrawing the map of the Middle East would also help isolate Syria, Iraq's ally, and Israel's archenemy along its northern border. Thus, in the early 1990s, after the U.S.-led war in the Gulf, a small elite team of Israeli commandos was given the order to train in absolute secrecy for an assassination mission to bring down the Baghdad ruler. The plan, codenamed Bramble Bush, was to first kill a close friend of the Iraqi leader outside the country, someone from Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Then, after learning the date and time of the funeral to be held in the town, a funeral Hussein was certain to attend, they would have time to covertly infiltrate a team of commandos into the country to carry out the assassination. The murder weapons were to be specially modified smart missiles that would be fired at Hussein as he stood in a crowd at the funeral. But the plan was finally abandoned after five members of the team were accidentally killed during a dry run of the operation. Nevertheless, removing Saddam and converting Iraq from threat to ally had long been at the top of Israel's wish list. Now, Pearl, Feith, and Wurmser were suggesting something far more daring. Not just an assassination, but a bloody war that would get rid of Saddam Hussein and also change the face of Syria and Lebanon. Pearl felt their clean break recommendations were so important that he personally hand-carried the report to Netanyahu. Wisely, Netanyahu rejected the task force's plan. But now, with the election of a receptive George W. Bush, they dusted off their preemptive war strategy and began getting ready to put it to use. The new Bush policy was an aggressive agenda for any president, but especially for someone who had previously shown little interest in international affairs. "We're going to correct the imbalances of the previous administration on the Mideast conflict," Bush told his freshly assembled senior national security team in the Situation Room on January 30, 2001. "We're going to tilt it back toward Israel. Anybody here ever met Ariel Sharon?" Only Colin Powell raised his hand. Bush was going to reverse the Clinton policy, which was heavily weighted toward bringing the bloody conflict between Israel and the Palestinians to a peaceful conclusion. There would be no more U.S. interference. He would let Sharon resolve the dispute however he saw fit, with little or no regard for the situation of the Palestinians. The policy change was exactly as recommended by the Pearl Task Force's Clean Break report. "I'm not going to go by past reputations when it comes to Sharon," Bush told his newly gathered national security team. "I'm going to take him at face value. We'll work on a relationship based on how things go." Then he mentioned a trip he had taken with the Republican-Jewish coalition to Israel. "We flew over the Palestinian camps. Looked real bad down there," he said with a frown. Then he said it was time to end America's efforts in the region. "I don't see much we can do over there at this point," he said. Colin Powell, Secretary of State for only a few days, was taken by surprise. The idea that such a complex problem, in which America had long been heavily involved, could simply be brushed away with a sweep of a hand made little sense. Fearing Israeli-led aggression, he quickly objected. He stressed that a pullback by the United States would unleash Sharon and the Israeli army, recalled Paul O'Neill, who had been sworn in as Secretary of the Treasury by Bush only hours before and was seated at the table. Powell told Bush, "The consequences of that could be dire, especially for the Palestinians." But Bush just shrugged. "Sometimes a show of strength by one side can really clarify things," he said. "Powell seemed startled," said O'Neill. Over the following months, to the concern of Powell, the Bush-Sharon relationship became extremely tight. "This is the best administration for Israel since Harry Truman," said Thomas Newman, executive director of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, a pro-Israel advocacy group. In an article in the Washington Post titled "Bush and Sharon Nearly Identical on Mideast Policy," Robert G. Kaiser noted the dramatic shift in policy. "For the first time," wrote Kaiser, "a U.S. administration and a Likud government in Israel are pursuing nearly identical policies. Earlier U.S. administrations, from Jimmy Carter's through Bill Clinton's, held Likud and Sharon at arm's length, distancing the United States from Likud's traditionally tough approach to the Palestinians." Using the Yiddish term for supporters of Sharon's political party and referring to the new warm relationship between Bush and Sharon, a senior U.S. government official told Kaiser, "The Likudniks are really in charge now." With America's long struggle to bring peace to the region quickly terminated, George W. Bush could turn his attention to the prime focus of his first National Security Council meeting, ridding Iraq of Saddam Hussein. Condoleezza Rice led off the discussion. But rather than mention anything about threats to the United States or weapons of mass destruction, she noted only that Iraq might be the key to reshaping the entire region. The words were practically lifted from the Clean Break report, which had the rather imperial-sounding subtitle, "A New Strategy for Securing the Realm." Then Rice turned the meeting over to CIA Director George Tenet, who offered a grainy overhead picture of a factory that he said might be a plant that produced either chemical or biological materials for weapons manufacture. There were no missiles or weapons of any kind, just some railroad tracks going to a building, truck activity, and a water tower, things that can be found in virtually any city in the United States. Nor were there any human intelligence or signals intelligence reports. "There was no confirming intelligence," Tenet said. It was little more than a shell game. Other photos and charts showed U.S. air activity over the no-fly zone, but Tenet offered no more intelligence. Nevertheless, in a matter of minutes, the talk switched from a discussion about very speculative intelligence to which targets to begin bombing in Iraq. By the time the meeting was over, Treasury Secretary O'Neill was convinced that getting Hussein was now the administration's focus. That much was already clear. But, O'Neill believed, the real destabilizing factor in the Middle East was not Saddam Hussein, but the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the issue Bush had just turned his back on. 10 years after the Gulf War, said O'Neill, Hussein seemed caged and defanged. Clearly there were many forces destabilizing the region, most particularly the Arab-Israeli conflict itself, which we were now abandoning. The war summit must also have seemed surreal to Colin Powell, who said little during the meeting and had long believed that Iraq no longer posed a threat to the United States. As he would tell German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer just a few weeks later, "What we and other allies have been doing in the region have succeeded in containing Saddam Hussein and his ambitions. They don't really possess the capability to attack their neighbors the way they did 10 years ago. Containment has been a successful policy." In addition to the clean break recommendations, David Wormser, only weeks before the NSC meeting, had further elaborated on the way the United States might go about launching a preemptive war throughout the Middle East. America's and Israel's responses must be regional, not local, he said. Israel and the United States should adopt a coordinated strategy to regain the initiative and reverse their region-wide strategic retreat. They should broaden the conflict to strike fatally, not merely disarm, the centers of radicalism in the region, the regimes of Damascus, Baghdad, Tripoli, Tehran, and Gaza. That would reestablish the recognition that fighting with either the United States or Israel is suicidal. Many in the Middle East will then understand the merits of being an American ally and of making peace with Israel. In the weeks and months following the NSC meeting, Pearl, Feith, and Wormser began taking their places in the Bush administration. Pearl became chairman of the reinvigorated and powerful Defense Policy Board, packing it with like-minded neoconservative superhawks anxious for battle. Feith was appointed to the highest policy position in the Pentagon, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And Wormser moved into a top policy position in the State Department, before later becoming Cheney's top Middle East expert. With the Pentagon now under Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, both of whom had also long believed that Saddam Hussein should have been toppled during the first Gulf War, the war planners were given free rein. What was needed, however, was a pretext, perhaps a major crisis. Crises can be opportunities, wrote Wormser in his paper calling for an American-Israeli preemptive war throughout the Middle East. Seeing little reason or intelligence justification for war at the close of the inaugural National Security Council meeting, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill was perplexed. Who exactly was pushing this foreign policy? He wondered to himself. And why Saddam? Why now? And why was this central to U.S. interests? Chapter 11. Capitol Hill. Israel had always been a central focus for Pearl, Feith, and Wormser. As a young staffer on Capitol Hill, working for Democratic Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, Pearl built his reputation as a pro-Israel activist. Richard Pearl and Morris Amite, a staffer for Connecticut Democratic Senator Abraham Ribicoff, command a tiny army of Semitophiles on Capitol Hill and direct Jewish power in behalf of Jewish interests, wrote Stephen D. Isaacs, the Washington Post's former New York bureau chief, in his 1975 book, Jews and American Politics. The new Jewish activists, wrote Isaacs, plunged forward on narrowly Jewish causes with scant regard for the old liberalism. When once upon a time all Jews in positions of power would have concentrated their attentions on the naming of a new Supreme Court justice for the United States, one of the most important of the new Jewish activists was more concerned with arms for Israel. Isaacs was referring to Pearl, who told him, I had all three of my telephone lines tied up, juggling calls, working on a Jackson Amendment on aid to Israel. The telephone rang, and it was the Washington representative of one of the Jewish organizations. I figured he was calling in with a report on the response of some senator to our aid to Israel lobbying efforts. He wanted to talk about William H. Rehnquist, nominated to the Supreme Court. I said, Jesus Christ, don't you know we're in the middle of a crisis? And he said, well, I also wanted to talk about that. And I said, well, what do you know? And the other crisis he had in mind was Bangladesh. Among Jackson's greatest supporters were members of the neoconservative movement. Predominantly Jewish, they were turned off by the counterculture movements of the 1960s, disillusioned with the Great Society, offended by the anti-American sentiments of the left, and fearful of the expansionist aims of the United Nations. At the core of the movement was a small but prolific band of sedentary intellectuals and think tank warriors, including Norman Podaritz and Irving Kristol. In limited circulation journals, they wrote longingly of a muscular expansion of American power and influence around the world, a rollback of communism, and an end to détente with the Soviets, and the creation of a seamless bond between Israel's interests and America's military and foreign policy. I think the term neoconservative has something to do with the sense that those of us who are now called neoconservatives were at one time liberals, said Pearl. And I think that's a fair description, and I suppose all of us were liberal at one time. I was liberal in high school and a little bit into college, but reality and rigor are important tonics, and if you got into the world of international affairs and you looked with some rigor at what was going on in the world, it was really hard to be liberal and naive. For Jackson, Pearl was far more than a simple staffer, running around putting briefing books together or drafting constituent correspondence. One newspaper called him the quintessential Washington operator because of his ability to manipulate the news and conventional opinions. He was also known as a great collector of sensitive information, something that occasionally raises security questions. Nevertheless, the two became a power team. Jackson and Pearl have established themselves as active players in the policymaking process, a status rarely achieved on Capitol Hill, said reporter Robert G. Kaiser in the Washington Post in 1977. Others found Pearl arrogant, difficult to deal with, and single-minded. Aided by Pearl, Jackson quickly became Israel's number one man in the Congress, constantly pushing for more and more money with fewer restrictions. In fiscal year 1970, Israel received military credits from the United States worth $30 million. But thanks to a Jackson amendment, the next year the amount skyrocketed to $545 million. By 1974, it had reached an extraordinary $2.2 billion, more than 70 times what it had been just 4 years earlier. "We have a hero, and his name is Henry Jackson," gushed Mitchell Wahlberg, a Washington, D.C. rabbi. "More than any other leader on the American political scene, Senator Henry Jackson has been there in our times of trouble and pain." Beyond Israel, the other major focus of Pearl and Jackson was weapons of mass destruction, Soviet ballistic missiles. Jackson was the leading advocate of an anti-ballistic missile system that would be able to knock down incoming nuclear warheads. It was one of the most controversial and contentious issues of the day. Opponents argued that building such a system would be the opening shot in a new arms race. Not only would the United States have to compete with the Soviet Union on building more and bigger missiles, it would now also have to compete in building more and bigger anti-missile systems. But Jackson and his supporters argued that the Soviets had already deployed such a system around Moscow, and America was falling behind. One of his principal outside consultants helping to prepare legislation to push such a system through Congress was a University of Chicago mathematician who specialized in strategic warfare planning, Albert J. Wohlstetter. Among a small cadre of intellectual hawks, their weapons of choice were slide rules and slim pieces of squeaky chalk. Wars were fought not on battlefields, but on blackboards covered with advanced mathematical formulas, like hieroglyphics on an ancient Egyptian tomb. Their language was Pentagonese, cluttered with acronyms and infused with the arcane euphemisms of mass death, kill ratios, throw weight, megatons. And they wore uniforms of tweed and corduroy as they shuttled from think tank to faculty lounge to corporate boardroom. Born in New York in 1913, Wohlstetter went on to serve as a consultant for the War Production Board during World War II and later joined RAND. At RAND, Wohlstetter's work helped lead to the Cold War concept of failsafe. The idea was that bombers armed with nuclear weapons would be launched immediately toward Russia at the first indication of an attack, but forbidden from dropping their loads until they received an encrypted confirmation message from the president. He also helped develop the theory of second-strike deterrence, where some missiles would be hardened, buried in the ground, to be able to survive a first strike in order to retaliate with a second strike. "To deter an attack means being able to strike back in spite of it," he wrote in his 1958 paper, The Delicate Balance of Terror. By the 1960s, Wohlstetter was becoming known as the intellectual godfather of Cold War hawks. He strongly opposed any form of detente or disarmament, and instead developed strategies not for passive deterrence, but for active fighting and winning both conventional and nuclear wars. These ideas included building smarter bombs and taking preemptive action, attacking first with surgical pinpoint strikes against key military targets. Wohlstetter also weighed in firmly in favor of American expansionism. "He was a firm believer in a global order," noted writer Karam Hussein, "underwritten by America's might and secured through the export of American secular and humanistic values to the rest of the world. In his view, America could not be a great power without a worldwide web of interests. In 1962, Wohlstetter left RAND, but remained a part-time consultant, and, after brief stints at Berkeley and UCLA, joined the University of Chicago's Political Science Department in 1964. There he continued his nuclear weapons research, as well as his opposition to détente and disarmament. Slowly, he began developing a cult-like following among some of his students, and others within the right-wing establishment. In Scoop Jackson, Wohlstetter found a soulmate. Throughout his career, Jackson considered initiatives to bring the arms race under control to be appeasement, and constantly fought against them. In 1969, he and Wohlstetter began fighting their biggest political battle as they tried to win passage of a bill that would fund development of an anti-ballistic missile system, ABM. The ABM debate was scheduled for the summer of 1969, with Jackson leading the battle on behalf of the Nixon administration and Wohlstetter acting as his principal theoretician. With enormous stakes riding on the outcome of the vote, Wohlstetter needed all the help he could get and decided to call two students he thought might be able to help out. Their names were Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz. I, at the time, was a graduate student of Albert Wohlstetter at the University of Chicago, recalled Wolfowitz, who was 24 at the time. It was during the ABM debate in 1969. And on the morning of the debate, lucky for me, Albert was in California, so I had the good fortune to be the one to take our charts to Senator Jackson all by myself and brief him. I had never personally met a senator in my life, and I probably would have been awestruck at that time by even the most insignificant member of that great body. And there I was, face to face with one of the titans. Richard Pearl, then 25 years old, also recalled the first time all four, Pearl, Wolfowitz, Jackson, and Wohlstetter, came together. Albert Wohlstetter phoned me one day. I was still a graduate student at Princeton doing some research in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he said, "Could you come to Washington for a few days and interview some people and draft a report on the current debate shaping up in the Senate over ballistic missile defense, which was a hot issue in the 1969 debate?" This was in 1969, and he said, "I've asked somebody else to do this too, and maybe the two of you could work together." The someone else was Paul Wolfowitz. Pearl had first met Wohlstetter while in high school in California. "Albert's daughter Joan was a classmate at Hollywood High School," he recalled. "We sat next to each other in Spanish class. She passed, I didn't, but she invited me over for a swim, and her dad was there. We got into a conversation about strategy, a subject I really didn't know much about. Albert gave me an article to read." That was typical of Albert. Sitting there at the swimming pool, I read the article, which was a brilliant piece of exposition, and obviously so. We started talking about it. It was called "The Delicate Balance of Terror." It became quite a famous article in Foreign Affairs, and it was a way of looking at the strategic relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union and the product of the serious piece of research that he had done as the director of the Research Council at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica. Following Hollywood High, Pearl went on to graduate from the University of Southern California and then Princeton with a master's degree in politics in 1967, before beginning studies for his Ph.D. To Wolfowitz, Wohlstetter registered a blank. "One of my professors at Cornell said, 'And by the way, there's this guy, Albert Wohlstetter, who's just moving to University of Chicago from RAND, and you and he would probably get along very well.' I'd never heard of the man, if that tells you something about how unconnected I was to the field. This was 1965. I arrive in Chicago. The first student faculty tea, I'm introduced to Wohlstetter, and he said, 'Oh, are you related to Jack Wolfowitz?' I said, 'As a matter of fact, that's my father.' He said, 'I studied mathematics with him and Abraham Wald at Columbia.'" The ensuing ABM debate became one of the most dramatic events in the history of the Senate. "I was told later that Scoop literally mopped the floor with Senator Symington's chart," said Wolfowitz, who, like Pearl, would become a protege of both Wohlstetter and Jackson. The vote was 51-50 in favor of the missile system, with Vice President Spiro T. Agnew breaking the tie. The Cold War between the United States and Russia would eventually end, and Albert Wohlstetter and Scoop Jackson would quietly disappear from the scene. But their proteges, Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl, would become their intellectual disciples. After his stint in Washington with Jackson and the ABM Treaty, Wolfowitz returned to the University of Chicago to continue his doctoral studies and then accepted a teaching position at Yale. While there, he began hammering away on his dissertation. His topic was nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, and he argued that the United States must do whatever it can to prevent even the hint of weapons of mass destruction from being introduced into the area. Wolfowitz also argued that American security was dependent not just on defending traditional allies from communist incursion. Equally important, he said, was going on the offense, when necessary, to protect America's vital economic interests, such as oil. They were the thoughts and words of a geopolitical activist, eager to use force and preemption to advance American power, words that must have greatly pleased his dissertation advisor, Albert Wohlstetter. In February 1980, Richard Perle quit Jackson's office and joined Abingdon Corporation, an international consulting firm, to earn substantially more than his Senate staffer pay. His chief client was an Israeli arms company called Soltam Limited. For much of his Senate career, he and his wife, Leslie Barr, who worked at the Department of Energy and later at Commerce, lived in a townhouse on Capitol Hill. The extra income allowed Perle to buy an aging, shingle-style, postmodern three-bedroom bungalow in the fashionable Washington, D.C. neighborhood of Chevy Chase. But his days in the private sector ended with Reagan's election. Nicknamed the Prince of Darkness, Perle became the Pentagon's new Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, a job that dealt with nuclear weapons issues worldwide, among other things. In turn, he nominated a young lawyer named Douglas J. Feith as his Deputy Assistant Secretary. It was an extraordinary appointment for someone just 6 years out of law school with only 2 years of experience in defense issues, but he was seen by many as Perle's protege. After receiving his bachelor's degree from Harvard, Doug Feith had gone on to Georgetown Law. While there, he joined up with Joseph Cherba, a longtime friend and associate of Rabbi Meir Kahane, whose violent Jewish Defense League was declared a terrorist organization in both the United States and Israel. Feith and Cherba co-authored an op-ed piece for the Washington Post that praised the tough anti-Palestinian policies of newly elected Prime Minister Menachem Begin. In 1981, he joined the Reagan administration's National Security Council as a Middle East expert, but he lasted only about a year. Nevertheless, Richard Perle took him under his wing as his special assistant in 1982, before skyrocketing him to the Deputy Assistant Secretary position in 1984. At the close of the Reagan years, many of the neocons, including Perle and Feith, left government, having received a chilly reception from George Bush Sr. when he became president. Soon after leaving the Pentagon and into the 1990s, Feith began turning more and more extreme in his pro-Israel and anti-Arab and Palestinian views. He churned out constant diatribes in Israeli newspapers complaining about the Israeli government's policy on settlements, there should be more, or the Oslo peace process, it should end, he was even against the Camp David peace accords, or the occupied territories, they belong to Israel, or the Palestinians, they belong in Jordan, or Iraq, there should be regime change. Rashid Khalidi, director of Columbia University's Middle East Institute, called Feith's published opinions quite extreme. Beyond angry newspaper opinions, Feith denounced President George H.W. Bush for his mistreatment of Israel and even organized a committee to fight him, the Committee on U.S. Interests in the Middle East, complete with a full-page ad in the New York Times. He advised the Israeli government to pressure the White House to depose Saddam Hussein, led a Senate effort to pressure the Clinton administration to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, became the head of a right-wing pro-Israel special interest group, the Center for Security Policy, became a founding member of One Jerusalem, an Israeli organization determined to prevent any compromise with the Palestinians over the fate of any part of Jerusalem, and became the vice chairman of the advisory board of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, a pro-Israel, defense-related special interest group. During these years, Feith was also putting together a legal practice. He teamed up with L. Mark Zell, a fellow associate from his days at the Washington law firm of Fried, Frank, Harris, Shriver, and Kampelman. Like Feith, Zell had turned into a zealot on the issue of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. In the late 1980s, he became an Orthodox Jew and decided to join the right-wing Israeli settler movement. U.S. policy has always been, and continues to be, adamantly opposed to Israeli settlements. Fife is a partner of Zell, and Zell is a leading settler, said Rashid Khalidi, Columbia University's Middle East Institute director. He lives in a settlement. He is an advocate of expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. He and Fife are ardent, committed, extremist Likud supporters. That is to say, they support a policy of Israel's expansion. They support a policy of crushing the Palestinians. They support the expansion of settlements. I can bear personal witness to Fife's adamancy on the issue of settlements, said Larry Kohler Essis. As a reporter during the late 1980s and early 1990s for Washington Jewish Week, whose attorney he was, I debated him several times over dinner on the very notion of Palestinian peoplehood. A few months after the Palestinian uprising known as the Intifada began in December 1987, Fife's partner, Zell, flew to Israel to lend his support to the settlers. He had received his welcoming indoctrination into the settler movement the year before in Israel by Gush Emunim, Block of the Faithful, the point on the spear for the extreme right-wing Israeli settlement group. Just a few years earlier, Gush Emunim devised a plot to blow up the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock, the third holiest site in Islam. Their goal was to start a cataclysmic war between Jews and Muslims to hasten the coming of the Messiah, and also to scuttle the Camp David Accord, which called for the return of land under Israeli control to the Palestinians. The act was never carried out, only because in the end the plotters could not get rabbinical backing. Soon after moving into the right-wing settlement of Alon Shvut, about 20 minutes south of Jerusalem, Zell and Fife opened their Jerusalem office, and the two began soliciting Israeli-American business. While Mark Zell remained on the front lines of the settlement movement in Israel, Fife, the managing partner of the firm, was the settler's man in Washington. In July, he joined with Pearl, David Wormser, and Wormser's Israeli-born wife, Mariav, to develop the foreign policy position paper Clean Break for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Soon after helping to write the report, David Wormser became the director of the Middle East Studies program at the American Enterprise Institute, where Pearl also worked. His position was funded by Irving Moskowitz, a wealthy American who was a key financial backer of Jewish settlements in Israel's occupied territories. Mariav Wormser founded an organization, Memri, that translates Arabic press reports that highlight negative views of the West. A few months after they finished the Clean Break proposal, Fife's Center for Security Policy issued a paper titled, Israeli Settlements, Legitimate, Democratically Mandated, Vital to Israel's Security, and, therefore, in U.S. Interest. The document claimed, Israel is fully entitled to expand existing settlements or build new ones in the disputed territories. By 1997, Fife was going so far as to call for Israel to repudiate the Oslo Peace Accords and launch a full-scale war against the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Repudiate Oslo, he wrote in a paper titled A Strategy for Israel. Such a violent move, he acknowledged, would lead to a massive upheaval in the territories and the prospect of confrontation with 50,000 or so PA, Palestinian Authority, policemen with automatic weapons. Then he added coldly, any strategy for repudiating Oslo must therefore take into account the price in blood Israel would have to pay. Following Fife's call for a war against the occupied Palestinians, Pearl, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and a small group of neocons signed a letter to President Clinton pleading with him to make the ouster of Saddam Hussein the aim of American foreign policy and to use military force. If he agreed, they wrote, they would offer our full support in this difficult but necessary endeavor. Clinton, however, made only a token effort, lobbing cruise missiles into Iraq, and refused to involve United States forces in a ground war to oust Hussein. But Pearl and Wolfowitz soon found a sympathetic ear with George W. Bush, and at the start of his candidacy, he named them as top advisors to his foreign policy team, then being coordinated by Condoleezza Rice. Thus, it was little wonder that during his first National Security Council meeting, when the only topics on the agenda were Israel and Iraq, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill thought that all the issues had already been decided. The meeting had seemed scripted, he thought. Rumsfeld had said little, Cheney nothing at all, though both men had long entertained the idea of overthrowing Saddam. Was a multi-pronged assault on Saddam Hussein really a priority in early 2001? What most concerned him was that the entire thrust of the meeting had been only about the hows of the attack, but it was the whys that still confused him. Chapter 12. War Room. It was pre-dawn when Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld emerged from his $3,350,000 three-story brick house in the Colorama section of Washington and stepped into the back of his armored SUV. Named for the Greek word for beautiful view, Colorama is a small residential neighborhood that sits on a low hill near the edge of the city's gray-columned federal heart. It is a land of faux Tudor mansions and state embassies, with colorful flags and shiny gold plaques. Black Lincolns, many with red, white, and blue diplomatic tags, prowl the neighborhood like silent panthers, and residents such as California Senator Dianne Feinstein and former Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson line the pages of the Green Book, Washington's social register. As his convoy snaked its way through downtown Washington on the morning of September 11, 2001, Rumsfeld, with slicked down hair and wire-rimmed bifocals, and dressed in his trademark tab-collared shirt and gray suit, thumbed through a copy of The Early Bird, a compilation of that morning's most important national and international press clippings. He was checking for coverage of his talk to the Pentagon workforce the previous day. In that speech, Rumsfeld had declared war against the country's most serious enemy. "The topic today," he said, "is an adversary that poses a threat, a serious threat, to the security of the United States of America. This adversary is one of the world's last bastions of central planning. It governs by dictating five-year plans. From a single capital, it attempts to impose its demands across time zones, continents, oceans, and beyond. With brutal consistency, it stifles free thought and crushes new ideas. It disrupts the defense of the United States and places the lives of men and women in uniform at risk." The enemy was not Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden. "It was," said Rumsfeld, "the Pentagon bureaucracy. Not the people, but the processes. Not the civilians, but the systems. Not the men and women in uniform, but the uniformity of thought and action that we too often impose on them." In the early morning of September 11, 2001, the greatest threat facing the nation, according to Rumsfeld, was Pentagon red tape. But within hours, he would be gunning for a different enemy, a target of opportunity located in Baghdad. Shortly after the devastating explosion caused when American Airlines Flight 77 slammed into the Pentagon, Rumsfeld and other officials evacuated to the bomb-proof War Room, the National Military Command Center, in the Pentagon's basement. Then, at 5 minutes past noon, CIA Director George Tenet passed him the information intercepted by NSA at 9:53 that morning, only minutes after the crash. A bin Laden operative in Afghanistan, Tenet related, had telephoned a number in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia and asked if he had heard good news. At the same time, he had indicated that at least one more target was yet to be hit. 10 minutes later, United Flight 93 crashed in Pennsylvania, en route to a fourth target in Washington. Yet despite the implications that a member of bin Laden's team appeared to have foreknowledge of one of the attacks, Rumsfeld dismissed the intelligence as vague, that it might not mean something, and there was no good basis for hanging hat. The clear evidence aside, it was not the Afghan cave dweller that Rumsfeld was interested in. At 2:40 that afternoon, an aide to the defense secretary jotted notes of Rumsfeld's conversations. Written deep in the war room, the notes described the Pentagon chief as wanting best info fast, judge whether good enough hit SH, Saddam Hussein, at same time, not only UBL, Osama bin Laden. Go massive, he noted, sweep it all up, things related and not. From the notes, it was clear that the attacks would be used as a pretext for war against Saddam Hussein. Despite the fact that there was absolutely no evidence implicating the Iraqi leader, Rumsfeld wanted to hit SH at same time. The idea was to sweep him up, whether related to 9/11 or not. Wolfowitz had the same idea and quickly began talking up an Iraqi connection in conference calls with other officials, including Cheney. 12 hours later, around 2 o'clock in the morning of September 12th, counterterrorism coordinator Richard Clark headed back to the White House for a series of meetings. He had just left the building a little more than an hour before in order to take a shower and put on some clean clothes. "I expected to go back to a round of meetings examining what the next attack should be," he recalled, "what our vulnerabilities were, what we could do about them in the short term." Clark continued, "Instead, I walked into a series of discussions about Iraq. At first I was incredulous that we were talking about something other than getting Al-Qaeda. Then I realized with almost a sharp physical pain that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz were going to try to take advantage of this national tragedy to promote their agenda about Iraq. Since the beginning of the administration, indeed well before, they had been pressing for a war with Iraq. My friends in the Pentagon have been telling me that the word was we would be invading Iraq sometime in 2002. On the morning of the 12th, DOD's focus was already beginning to shift from Al-Qaeda. By the afternoon on Wednesday, Secretary Rumsfeld was talking about broadening the objectives of our response and getting Iraq. I vented. Having been attacked by Al-Qaeda, for us now to go bombing Iraq in response would be like our invading Mexico after the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Later in the day, Secretary Rumsfeld complained that there were no decent targets for bombing in Afghanistan and that we should consider bombing Iraq, which, he said, had better targets. At first I thought Rumsfeld was joking, but he was serious, and the president did not reject out of hand the idea of attacking Iraq. Instead, he noted that what we needed to do with Iraq was to change the government, not just hit it with more cruise missiles, as Rumsfeld had implied.